Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the confidential Justice Department memo leaked to NBC News that authorizes the U.S. government to order the killing of American citizens if they are believed to be al-Qaeda leaders, even if there is no intelligence that they are actively involved in a plot to attack the United States. Bradley J. Strausser, a professor in the Defense Analysis Department at the United States Naval Postgraduate School and author of Killing by Remote Control, The Ethics of an Unmanned Military, joins us to discuss targeted killing, an issue that is bound to dominate Thursday's confirmation hearing of John Brennan to head up the CIA. Then we are joined in the studio by the filmmakers of the Academy Award-nominated documentary feature Five Broken Cameras. Palestinian farmer and cameraman Ahmad Bernat and Israeli documentary filmmaker Guy Davidi discuss their powerful film that documents the encroachment of Israeli settlers on a Palestinian village where Ahmad and his wife and four sons live. Five Broken Cameras reveals the shocking ground truth of the Israeli-Palestinian struggle, provided by the five cameras Ahmad uses, as one by one of them are destroyed by the Israeli army over a six-year period, while Palestinian villagers are beaten and killed by Israelis with impunity as they engage in nonviolent protest trying to protect their farms, homes, and families. Joining us now is Dr. Bradley J. Strausser, who's an assistant professor in the Defense Analysis Department at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. He's also a research associate at Oxford University's Institute for Ethics, Law, and Armed Conflict, and previously taught philosophy at the United States Air Force Academy and the University of Connecticut. His forthcoming book is Killing by Remote Control, The Ethics of an Unmanned Military. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Bradley J. Strausser.
Thanks for having me.
And this memo that was a 16-page memo from the Justice Department that was leaked to NBC News, apparently it's titled Lawfulness of a Lethal Operation Directed Against a U.S. Citizen Who is a Senior Operational Leader of al-Qaeda or an Associated Force. Now, my understanding is that this memo was given to members of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee and the Judiciary Committee. So I think it's reasonable to assume that the leak came from there. But there's a bipartisan group of 11 senators led by Democrat Ron Wyden of Oregon who have written to the president asking him to release all Justice Department memos on the subjects of drones and targeted killings. So this looks to me like perhaps somebody's trying to force the president's hand here. What's your reading on it?
Yes, as you just described it, that's my best understanding of it as well. It's entirely possible the leak is from someone on one of the Senate committees you just mentioned. It's also, of course, possible that someone from within the White House or within the program itself, who knows. It's unclear exactly what, for example, Senator Wyden is after. They do speak of the memos in the plural. That's an important point to make here. And then this DOG white paper, I'm sorry, Department of Justice white paper, is not the memo, for example, that was used to justify various killings. The thought here is there must be classified specific memos for specific cases. But what people like, for example, Scott Shane at the New York Times and others have reported is that the legal reasoning in this this white paper parallels that which is used in the classified memos. Now, I should say, Senator Wyden, it's interesting that he was part of the senators asking for the Obama administration to release more memos because he is on the United States Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. And the SSCI, as it's sometimes referred to, they don't like it if you call them the SISI, but the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, they have the power to have really anything they want disclosed to them by these operations, being any covert action taken by the CIA or the executive branch. They have the power over them to really demand anything they want, and they can stop these programs if they want. It's important to remember back in the 80s, under the Reagan administration and the Boland Amendment, when the Senate did kind of flex its muscle and enforce this power. They control the funding for it. If they wanted to, they could cut off the funding for the program and kind of force the administration's hand here. That's why I'm just so confused by it. I'm not sure what memos they have seen. I'm not sure what they haven't. I'm not sure what intelligence they've been briefed on. But it would be very odd to me if they've gone and demanded certain intelligence briefings on these actual operations and haven't been given it by the CIA. Now, it's possible the White House is not providing all the memos. But again, if that is the case, the SSCI could They could demand this, and they have the administrative power and tools at their means to really force a hand if they wanted to. So the fact that they haven't done so, but yet they continue to make these public statements of saying, hey, we need more transparency, I'm really confused as to the domestic politics on it, to be quite frank with you. I'm not sure what's really going on between the Senate Committee on Intelligence and the White House here.
And, of course, this is all happening a couple of days in advance of Thursday's Senate nomination hearings for John Brennan to head up the CIA. And probably nobody in the U.S. government knows more about the drone program than John Brennan, right?
Yes, absolutely. The timing of these public statements against the White House about releasing these memos has to, of course, be it's not a coincidence that it coincides with John Brennan's confirmation hearings, nor perhaps Chuck Hagel's either. It does seem like there's some political theater going on. I would just stress that it's not just these senators and the Judiciary Committee and the Intelligence Committee, but the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, as well as the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. They both have the power to demand to be fully disclosed on any of these things, and if they feel like they're not getting the information they need to be a proper oversight over these kind of programs, they have the power, they have the administrative tools, a broad number of them, in fact, such that they could stop the White House from doing this. So the fact that they're not doing that, but yet they keep demanding more transparency is odd to me. I'm not sure what's going on. I have a feeling that they actually are briefed in far more than they are admitting. But of course, in this controversial topic, I think all politicians would rather have just the White House hold the political bag and not have themselves have to, you know, bear any of the burden of saying that they're approving this or overseeing it, because that implicates them as well in this controversial program.
Well, I would share with you my skepticism along those lines. It feels like they want to look like they're on the side of wanting more disclosure, but frankly, they don't really want to know about it, and they're perfectly happy to leave the ambiguity with the president, which just seems to be where it is, right? It's essentially, we don't know exactly what the mechanics are, but I believe the president is provided with a list, and he ultimately has to make the decision. But it's worth, I think, putting this in the broader context of this has been a part of presidential power in the post-war period, has it not? The ability of a president to essentially press a button he still has the attaché case called the football following him around. And, of course, in that case, nuclear war would involve the death of considerably people than target assassinations do. So give us a sense of where this stands in history of presidential powers over life and death matters.
Well, I would agree with some of what you just said. I would be careful, though, with some of the ways it's been portrayed as sort of a hit list by some people, that the president just sits down every Tuesday in these meetings and picks somebody. I don't think that's quite accurate. From my understanding is that there's these really complicated streams of intelligence constantly coming in and being evaluated, and they're trying to evaluate different threats. This is mainly the CIA, but as well as the other intelligence agencies through a variety of intelligence sources, trying to evaluate different threats and then trying to ascertain what are the best ways to block those threats. And then those different means or opportunities of blocking those threats, I think, are then presented up and down throughout the executive branch and within the CIA itself. And then I think the president is involved in some of those discussions. But I think it's constantly changing and evolving depending on their intelligence for the threat. So I wouldn't put it in those terms as just like a list that the president picks from. But I do agree that it's certainly perhaps an unsettling thing to think about, this kind of power. I would note, however, that this, I don't think it really is anything new in the broader question of a state killing people that it takes to be an imminent threat. That is to say, I think the conversation over drones here is a little bit of a red herring. I don't think it matters in this broader discussion whether or not it's drones or a sniper carrying out this policy. I think what should really concern us here, the more important question, is what terms, in this case from this white paper, the Department of Justice and the executive branch more broadly, is using to define and measure and evaluate imminence or imminent threat. Are they talking about an imminent threat like, for example, this recent hostage situation in Alabama, where this guy, Jimmy Lee Dykes, he had a gun on a child in his underground prison. Is it that kind of imminent threat? You know, in that moment, the police in that situation, they decided that for whatever information they have, which I'm not sure what it was, but they decided that he was an imminent threat and a danger to this child, so they took action and they killed him. Now, no one in that case is arguing that his due process rights were violated or that he was somehow failed to, you know, be granted habeas corpus. Everybody, I think, agrees in that case. He was clearly an imminent threat. But is that what they mean by imminent threat, or are they taking a much fuzzier, broader definition and evaluation of imminent threat, similar to perhaps how the Bush administration claimed with Saddam Hussein using WMDs as a justification for Iraq war? It seems like, just, and I'm not a legal scholar, but it seems like in reading the white paper that they're taking a much broader definition. In fact, they say that explicitly. We're taking a much broader definition of imminent threat. But the idea that a state has the political power to kill a person who is posing an imminent threat of unjustified harm to innocent people, that really, in principle anyway, isn't new. It's the way that they're defining that language and making that legal justification that is perhaps new.
But along with this elastic definition of imminent threat in these leaked documents from the Department of Justice, there's also this idea that the targeting of these people means that that capture must be unfeasible before they can be hit a drone. And my understanding of the rationale for the capture being unfeasible is, people say in the Pakistani territories near the Afghan border, more people would get killed trying to capture them than perhaps even the target cells would be killed. Therefore, the drone is the instrument of choice. Is that the rationale?
I think that's right. And that actually rationale has been promulgated by the White House since they first admitted to the drone campaign in both media reports and in interviews and in press conferences. They've said that for a long time. They've argued that, look, drones appear to be more capable of being more precise, more accurate, and cause less unintended harm to innocent civilians and bystanders than other alternatives. And moreover, they seem to be defining infeasible when they say, let me just go back really quickly. The white paper says that there are actually three things that need to be met. One, they have to, the targeted individual must pose an imminent threat of violent attack against the United States. And as I said, I think the real crux of this is, how are they measuring this concept of imminent? Is it the way most of us would think of imminent threat, or is it this really broadened, a loose definition of imminent threat? Many of us would take to be an abuse of the concept. But that's just the first one. The second one is, they say, like you just mentioned, capture must be infeasible. And then third, they say that it has to be conducted within the classic fundamental principles of the laws of war, such as necessitation and proportionality. But on the question of feasible capture, these questions, again, in principle, new. In the recent case, again, in Alabama with Jimmy Lee Dykes, who was just killed, took the child hostage in Alabama, I'm sure part of the consideration for deciding on whether or not to go in and use lethal force against this guy was, well, if we try to capture him, will that actually cause more harm, perhaps to the child or perhaps to law enforcement officers? So the same kind of considerations and calculations, of course, are being made here, and that's really all the white paper is claiming. The problem many people have with this, and I respect this concern a great deal, is that they fear that that kind of language is being abused to justify perhaps a drone strike simply because it'd be easier to do, but not because, in fact, capture would be more infeasible. And I think that's the danger and that's the worry, that that's being abused. But the principle behind it, again, is not really a new or radical claim, that you need to consider all the different risks that would come with capture over killing in any given case and what harm the likelihood of either of those options would produce. And I think we're obligated in any case to always err on the side of that which we think will predictably cause the least amount of harm to people involved.
So you've clearly studied this subject at length, Dr. Bradley J. Strosser. What's your explanation for the deeply felt outrage that a lot of Americans feel about drones? I mean, my sense is that I'm not entirely sure that sticking a bayonet in somebody's guts and watching them die is more honorable than killing somebody with a drone, but there's no question that the outrage is felt, and my understanding is that on the targeted side of it, it probably might well cause more jihadis to be recruited because it gives those people that are being targeted a sense of being so helpless against this unseen power out there that they're likely to be more enraged and humiliated than they are to want to sort of give up being jihadis or whatever.
Right, I agree. It's a tremendous concern. I think you've put your finger on a great deal of the outrage that is felt in both the areas of the world where drones are used and by American people. This thought that the efforts of the drone campaign might very well be counterproductive because they produce more backlash than anything they might, than any threats they might be stopping, could very well be true. People have been long arguing that. And you remember, very similar arguments were made with U.S. operations in Iraq and in other places. But I think the issue with drones for a lot of people is precisely the asymmetry you just pointed out, that there's this really radical asymmetry going on when one person in a fight doesn't even have any kind of human risk in the actual theater of operations where it's being carried out, that literally the people piloting the drones are on the other side of the world. I will say, however, that I think focusing on the drone part of this policy is actually a distraction. I think, again, it's not really about drones. The question is, what kind of policy do we want our state carrying out to kill people who they take to be imminent threat? And in that question, of course, I think we have right to demand, how are they measuring imminent threat? What are the definitions and terms used for imminent threat? And what is the evidence behind it? Of course, the problem with that is that the reasons that they're going to point to for saying, hey, this person is an imminent threat and that's why we felt that we had to kill them, of course, that data is classified, and they're going to claim national security reasons to keep it classified. So we're in this difficult situation where we need to have checks and balances and oversight. And again, I believe there is with the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, but in the public discussion, we're kind of stuck. We don't see what the evidence they have is to make this kind of claim, and they don't feel like they have a right to divulge it. Why are drones so crucial? There's a long conversation there about the psychology of it. But I think whether or not we as an American public should be, what our conversation should be over this is regarding the policy itself. You know, what the questions we should be asking our government and ourselves are not about drone technology, but about what moral imperatives should guide our defense policy and our defense philosophy as a state. The technology that's used to carry it out, I think the moral questions here really are the same. Again, whether it's a manned aircraft or an unmanned aircraft or whether it's a sniper, I think the moral principles behind it are not going to change. And those are the questions we really need to ask and demand from our government. And I think we're starting to finally see some of that come to light with this policy, with this white paper.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Bradley J. Strasser, what about this fact that technological advantages are always somewhat fleeting? You know, we had a monopoly on the atomic bomb for a while, and then the Russians got it. In this case, you know, 53 or 51 countries have drones, and it's I just was wondering how, in terms of blowback or technological advances by others, how would we feel if a Chinese drone was flying over LA somewhere, you know, looking for somebody that the Chinese government didn't like? And I mean, are we going to eventually have to be faced with those questions?
Well, the short answer, I think, is yes. We are going to have to face those questions. Unfortunately, military technology doesn't have a great track record of being contained. Now, I do think we can get out in front of some of the proliferation of any new military technology, and I commend the efforts of some people to do that. For example, there's the International Committee on Robot Arms Control, and a colleague of mine, Noel Sharkey, the chairman of that, amongst many other fine people, and they're working towards, let's set up some international treaties now. Let's get out ahead of the curve on this. But certainly, it seems like this technology is going to proliferate and it's not going to go away anytime soon because it has these clear military advantages. But in terms of your analogy of how would we feel about a Chinese drone flying over L.A. looking for somebody the Chinese government doesn't like, of course that would be awful. But I don't think that's apt. It's important to remember in these cases that, for example, in Yemen, where we're carrying out a lot of drone strikes right now, that Yemen and the United States are allies in this fight. And at least officially, you know, the Yemeni government claims that they are asking for the United States' help and working together as partners in trying to carry out these drone operations to find these terrorists that they are trying to block the what they claim to be an imminent threat from. So the analogy to China would only work if it was a situation where the United States and China were working together, say, to find somebody in Los Angeles that both nation states took to be a threat, that both nation states were trying to fight. So that's why it's important to remember in these cases that as much as the local populations of Yemen and Pakistan and the other areas where drone operations are going on may radically and passionately object to this policy, that officially the governments of these nations are allied with the United States in this effort and are working together. And that does radically change, I think, at least for many people, the way you think about these drone operations being carried out, that if Pakistanis are angry with drone strikes being carried out in the Fatah region, for example, they need to be frustrated just as much with Islamabad as they do with Washington, D.C.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, Dr. Bradley J. Strasser.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Bradley J. Strasser, who is an assistant professor in the Defense Analysis Department at the United States Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. He's also a research associate at Oxford University's Institute for Ethics, Law, and Armed Conflict, and taught philosophy at the United States Air Force Academy and in the University of Connecticut. His forthcoming book is Killing by Remote Control, The Ethics of an Unmanned Military.
We are the robots.